John Gilblue.
Hey, Mr. John. Eric here.
Hey, Eric. How's it going?
Excellent. Right time, right place?
Right time, right place, right person.
Fantastic.
Let her rip.
So, before we start, a couple of things. I want to just make sure ID you correctly. Are you still with CHD?
Yes. I am the executive director of the New York chapter.
Got it. Hold on. E. Oh, pen does not write. All right. Hold on a second. The ED of the New York chapter.
Yep.
And were you formerly legislative director?
Yeah.
Right. And someone else doing that now or what? I mean, I know things change, but.
It's honestly, it's not that formal, but yeah, I guess I'm not the legislative. I took over, like, we didn't have an executive director. And, so initially I just gave myself the title legislative director. And I've since sort of took over all the sort of administrative duties that an executive director does.
And New York's its own corporation?
Yeah, it's a separate corporation under the umbrella of National CHD.
Got it.
Yeah, so it's I don't know. I don't even know how you describe it. It's just a separate corporation.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It's as long as I understand, readers aren't going to care that much.
Yeah. Okay.
I just like to have a map. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm also the founder of the Autism Action Network. I also like to throw in that.
Yeah, that's
well.
Right. Which is where I think we should start, if that's okay.
Okay. Sure.
I heard that you got in because you had a kid hurt by a vaccine?
Yeah, I have two sons. My younger son, when he was an infant, was injured by vaccines. In retrospect, I think it happened a couple times. I think the first time happened when he was 60 days old, and I think he had a reaction. He got four shots on the same day, but which is pretty common, you know. And
I just can't stand the thought. Every time I even hear it,
I
can't stand
it. It could be worse. I mean, if you look at the CDC's official documents, they say it's okay to give up to 12 doses.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. You know, like on like the 6 month and the 12 month visit or something like that. So I think he got encephalopathy from the pertussis component of his DPT, and it did brain damage. And I think he got two more rounds of shots as a kid, and you know, during his first year. And I think each time he got them, I think he was injured further, because every time he had a round of shots, we saw loss of skills and changes in his physical health and his cognition.
Right.
And it became really, really obvious when he was a year old. So that's right after he turned a year old, we saw a professional evaluation. And so when he was only like 16 months old, he was diagnosed with autism, which at the time was too young to officially give an autism diagnosis. But we went to this clinical psychologist who'd been doing it for 20 years, and she said, your kid's got autism. And she was right. I mean, autism is a sort of a label that I think is used to describe a lot of neurological issues, you know, but after his third round of shots, which is right when he was a year old, he sort of developed a kind of classic autism symptoms, you know, associated with regression when kids are children. He lost his sense of pain. He would stare at like a ceiling fan or like the branches of a tree moving in the wind for prolonged periods of time. He stopped playing with toys. You know, he would just like kind of pick up something and kind of like flip it back and forth in his hand, you know, for hours, you know. It seemed like he was deaf, but he wasn't deaf. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you kind of go through the checklist of like, you know, does your toddler have signs of autism, you know, he just like right down the list. In fact, I was cleaning I remember this so vividly. I was cleaning the basement and I had the radio on, and I had a NPR on, and they were talking about autism, right? And we were like wondering what the hell's going on with our kid. And so you know, they asked the guests to go over what the symptoms of autism were. And so they start going through them. And as they start going through them, you know, mentally I'm going, check, 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 check. And like by the end of the segment, I was like, well, that's it. That's what he's got.
Right.
So that's how it all started.
So what I've been wanting to ask you is, why is there such resistance to the notion that these things called vaccines cause autism? I mean, this seems to be controversial. I don't understand that.
It's extremely controversial, and it's the kind of thing that, if you know, can ruin your career depending on what you do. I mean, you know, if you are a physician and you agree with that position, you can literally lose your license. And it's just sort of interesting how it evolved, because back in, this is really, believe it or not, in like in the 1970s and 80s, the idea that autism could be caused by a vaccine wasn't even controversial. Right? And in fact, there's many legal cases from that time period where that was the finding of the court, right? And legal scholars have gone back and looked at this and wrote about it, but it's just like, you know, that is, you know, an inconvenient truth, and we live in a time where inconvenient truths can be, you know, hidden away and denied, you know? And, but that was also when the vaccine industry was an incredibly tiny industry. Right. I think up until like the late 80s, the vaccine industry was a couple hundred billion dollar a year industry for everything. Right.
And just a couple of hundred billion or a couple of billion?
A couple hundred million.
Million dollars.
Yeah.
Not even a whole billion.
No, and you know the old saying, like a billion here, a billion there, eventually you're talking about real money.
Is that W.C. Fields? You know, was a million here. Anyway.
Exactly. I mean, the whole industry is what, you know, probably the center fielder of the Yankees makes, you know?
Yeah.
And, but then they brought in the Vaccine Act of 1986 that absolved them of any liability, and the vaccine industry in the United States and globally just took off like a rocket. And just sort of put it in perspective, in the first 6 months of 2021, Pfizer was paid $31 billion just for COVID. Okay.
And this is a big company with a lot of products.
Half a year, $31 billion, right? Now, to put that in perspective, the entire global vaccine market in 2019, before COVID, was about like $25 billion. That's for every vaccine sold in the world in 2019 was less than what COVID made. I mean, what Pfizer made on COVID shots. Oh, and that's just in the United States. Okay, just in the United States in the first half of 2021.
So, answered part of my question.
Vaccines are enormous source of money for the drug industry, because unlike drugs, it has no liability associated with it, right?
Right.
And that's one of the things that sort of drives us crazy, is Johnson & Johnson and Pfizer are basically serial felons. I mean, they've both paid billions upon billions of dollars in fines, you know? Just last year, Johnson & Johnson paid several $100 million in fines for covering up the asbestos that they had in their baby powder.
Yeah. For generations.
For generations. Yeah, for like 40 years or something like that. So, you know, big dollars.
So that answers part of my question, that the industry is huge, it's powerful, it's influential, the lobbyists are incredible. The every new show is sponsored by Pfizer, but I mean, right, among parents, among just ordinary people,
right,
there seems to be a really powerful emotional trigger when you even suggest that this that a medical device could have injured their kid.
Well, yeah, you know, it's been a drumbeat for a good 20 years now, right? And you know, people. You know, companies like Pfizer and Merck paid huge amounts of money for advertising and public relations to crank out the propaganda because it works, right? They're not stupid. And you know, it was sort of an absolutely necessary sort of defensive posture to respond to the growing body of data that showed clear and convincing connections between vaccines and autism and a whole variety of other vaccine-caused health issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't get a mom of a newborn to allow you to inject something into their child unless they're absolutely convinced that it's completely benign and safe. So any kind of criticism of vaccines was seen as just an existential threat to the enormous growth and profitability of the industry, right? Other things have happened as well. There's another thing that happened over, like, you know, over the last 20, 30 years or so, has been the sort of complete corporatization of medicine in the United States, right? Doctors are no longer sort of independent professionals in the classic way we think about doctors, mm-hmm. right? They don't work for themselves anymore. They don't work for their patients. They work for large medical services corporations who have algorithms that the doctors are expected to implement, okay? And there's been great limitations placed upon their the range of decision making that a doctor is allowed to make now compared to, you know, a generation ago. Mm-hmm. Right. And another thing that's gone on along with that is doctors, relatively speaking, have become sort of part of the proletariat, right? Doctors were once, a generation ago, had probably much higher prestige than they go, and probably much higher income than the vast majority of them probably had much higher incomes relatively than they do now, right? I mean, it's not unusual to see a physician these days driving around in sort of a beat-up Honda, right?
And before, it was always Mercedes.
Like, a top-of-the-line, yeah, Mercedes or a Cadillac, if you want to go back even further, right, when I was a kid, mm-hmm. back in the 60s, you know, so there's just has been absolute change, right? There's also and it's you know, and it gets even more sort of specific with autism, right? Because autism is generally considered to be a condition of children, because basically there really were no autistic people, or very, very, very few of them, until you had the explosion of children with autism starting in the 90s, right?
But this is the vaccine schedule goes from 7 to like 70 shots.
Exactly, right? It's the exact same time period, right? And so autism got framed as a condition of children and therefore the realm of pediatricians. And what pediatricians do the vast majority of the time, right? I've seen studies that say 80% of a pediatrician's billing is derived from administering vaccines.
Let's pause there. Hold on a second.
Okay.
80% of a pediatrician's billing is these office visits that involve that are for the purpose of administering vaccines.
That's right.
Well, this is the whole business. Right. 80%.
Yes. And it gets even more than that, because insurance companies offer premiums, bonuses for hitting vaccine administration targets, right? And for example, and you can find copies of these online, right? Like Blue Cross Blue Shield used to have one where if a pediatrician had 80% of their entire practice fully vaccinated according to the schedule for the kid's age, they would get a bonus of like $500 or even more dollars for every child in the practice, right? So it's not unusual for a pediatrician to have, you know, almost 1,000 kids in their practice, right? So that would be a $500,000 bonus.
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 Not base pay.
That's not
bonus.
Yeah, yeah. But the trick is you don't get it. It's either all or nothing. You either make the quota and you get the prize, or you got bupkis, right?
Right. So it's so competitive.
It provided a powerful incentive for physicians, pediatricians, to, you know, make sure every kid in their practice got the shots. And if you had a stubborn parent who would go along with it, you just kicked them out of the practice, because they could end up costing you that money, which is what's happened. I mean, basically, if you are a parent who does not want to go along with the CDC schedule of shots, you're going to have a difficult time finding a physician who is willing to work with you, particularly a pediatrician. My own son got kicked out of his practice for that reason.
So where is the informed consent piece in all of this? I mean, it seems to me that you have a right to, as far as I understand the law, the treaty, Nuremberg principles, you have a right to informed consent and to refuse medical treatment.
Yes, you do. Okay.
But in reality, if you can get thrown out of your doctor's office and no other doctor will pick you up for that same reason, then you really do not, in effect, have that.
Not really, no. No, unless you're willing to basically forego any kind of regular relationship with a doctor for your child. And then when you get in school, depending on which state you live in, you know, you have no choice. Like in New York, you know, if you want your child to go to school, public or private, they must adhere to the schedule. No exceptions. There are very, very few exceptions given for medical reasons, but those are almost impossible to get.
Right. This is so, you know, horrifying. I don't even have words for it.
No, it's pretty bad. Now, on the other hand, there's other states where that's not the case, mm-hmm. right? You know, at least a child could go to school. They will probably have the same pressure from their pediatricians to do it. So getting medical, a relationship with a pediatrician is going to be difficult, but at least they can go to school in, you know, every state except six. So, you know.
Oh, you mean there are six states that are very strict?
There are six states that do not allow any kind of conscience, religious, secular, philosophical, whatever they call it. What balance does the parent have any choice? And in six states, the parent has no choice. Okay, in 20 states, it's whether a kid gets a shot or not is completely at the parent's discretion, and the kid is still allowed to go to school.
Can we talk about the 1986 Act?
Sure. So the story behind the 1986 Act was in the 1970s and 80s, there were relatively few vaccines, and they were fairly dangerous. And there were a lot of lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers for injury done to kids. And the injuries tended to be very serious, and they tended to be lifelong, debilitate, like brain damage, what happened to my son. And the biggest violator of that, the biggest problem, was with the pertussis component of the various kinds of pertussis-related vaccines. Usually it's combined with the diphtheria and tetanus. and call it the DTP, the DPT, the DTAP, whatever. And it got to the point where a lot of drug companies just said, "Look, we're just not gonna do this anymore. It's like we can't make any money doing this." Right? And so what they came up with was supposed to be like a no fault insurance scheme to sort of protect insurance companies. And the original idea was that in those rare instances where children were injured by vaccines, they would get, you know, a quick and swift and generous award, you know, to sort of take care of them for the rest of their lives and pay for their medical care and stuff like that. All right, so that was the original idea, and the doctors and drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, got complete liability protection, right? It was passed in 86. It got into effect in 88, and not long after that is when you really saw this sort of explosion in the number of vaccines being given to kids and being required for kids to go to school. And over the years, it has become almost impossible for a child to get an award from the vaccine industry. Actually, it's called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Okay, childhood is in the name of it, right? Because that's when people got vaccines. Over the past 10, 20 years, it has become so difficult for an injured child to win in the vaccine court that most of the awards now are given to adults. And the single most common vaccine injury that they're given an award for are sort of neurological injuries to people's arms from flu shots, right? Mm. So children are almost completely out of this whole system that they came up with
for children.
You know, yeah. Mm. But in the meantime, though, you've seen, as we were talking about before, this you know, the growth of the vaccine industry from a couple hundred million dollars a year in the late 80s to probably around $20 billion in the United States in 2019. And this year, it's probably going to be worth something over $100 billion.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to that.
Pretty nice growth arc. You know?
I mean, we're in a total bonanza. I mean, it's really a gold rush right now, to say the least.
Oh, it is. Right. You know, and it is kind of like a gold rush because we're actually already seeing it. I just read today that Moderna and BioNTech's stocks have fallen 60% since August, right? Wall Street is perceiving of the gold rush with the COVID shots is about over, you know? And there's just been a whole series of just rapid-fire announcements over the last 2 weeks that indicate that the powers that be realize that the COVID gravy train and event, whatever you want to call it, is pretty much over. The unimpeachable source is the head of Pfizer, who is probably the single most important person in health and medicine today, probably in the world,
yeah.
Right? Pfizer is the biggest drug company in the world, right? And announced that it's very unlikely, which means there won't be a fourth booster. So what we're seeing now is they're going to try and get as many of the many people with the first two and get as many boosters out there before they got to figure out what they're going to do in the post Omicron world. They're talking about an Omicron specific shot. Pfizer says they can have it out by March, but who even knows if Omicron is going to be around in March, you know? So, and I think they're also acknowledging that basically those people in the United States, at least, who are refusing to get a shot aren't going to get it no matter what, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with the Supreme Court decision a couple of days ago, they realized that they're not going to be able to get the federal government to force people to do it. So, in a way, the party's over.
Are they still going to proceed with their green pass or their whatever health QR passport?
That's going to get by. That's going to get really difficult, right? Because they brought in the Green Pass when people still believed that, one, that if you got the vaccine, you weren't going to get the disease, and you weren't going to transmit the disease to anybody else. Okay. Now that was the message that was repeated over and over and over again by government officials, the media, people from the federal agencies, and so on. But if you look at the documents that Pfizer submitted to get the licenses for their shots in the first place, they never claimed that it would stop transmission, right? They never claimed that it would stop you from getting it right from the get-go. They said they think what this would do was to diminish symptoms and diminish the possibility of death, right? Which is basically exactly what they're saying now, almost 2 years later.
Well, and this was I was there for that discussion. I know that's what was said. That
Right,
was at least in
no one believed it. Well, it never became the material for the massive propaganda campaign that has accompanied this whole thing, you know. You never heard the president saying that. You never heard Trump saying that. You never heard Biden saying that. You never heard Fauci saying that. You never heard it on, you know, any of the major corporate media. They never told that story.
Well, how could they make it mandatory if if they also were saying it didn't work?
That's a good question.
Not that it hasn't stopped them from contradicting themselves, 25, 30 other times on major issues.
Sure. Like almost every time
Every, yeah.
Fauci speaks
He says
these
something
days.
other than what he said some other time.
Right. There you go. You know?
Right.
And the media just plays along with it. I mean, they never say, well, wait a minute. Didn't you just say that, you know, 3 months ago, X, Y, and Z, and now you're saying not X, Y, and Z? They never do
No,
that.
these are haircuts. These are not journalists. And anyone who is saying something is, as you well know from CHD, is getting deplatformed.
Sure,
And so you
sure.
can't get on Rachel Maddow. You never really could anyway.
Right. She's a
she's just a
shill.
shill for Merck, far as I'm
Right.
concerned. And how else would she make $30 million a year?
Well, look, I don't really, I don't exactly. Is that what she makes, 30 million a year?
That's what I'm told. She used to make seven, and
Wow.
well, it's
That's
ridiculous.
amazing.
It's ridiculous. Joe Scarborough makes 250,000 a week. So
Nice.
Scar, yeah. And Mika
Well,
gets
you
paid
know,
separately.
well, you'll say whatever you need to say to get money like that,
That's
right? I
right.
guess. But actually, I lost my train of thought that
This
I was going
seems
to
so
go off of that.
transparent, though, that the news media is paid to buy these companies. They whoever pays the piper calls the tune. Then you've got
Right.
Alphabet Incorporated and Facebook and everybody in deeply invested. They
Deeply.
are setting rules. Have you read the Google rules on what you can and cannot say about COVID and vaccines? I mean,
Not in a while, but it's really interesting, though, is that I remember when they first started like clamping down, and I forgot Google's head censor's name, but she came out and said that they were only going to allow information that came from authoritative sources, right? And that would be the CDC and the World Health Organization, right? And it's gotten the narrative in the United States has gotten so warped that you can actually get thrown off of YouTube and Google and Facebook for quoting directly from World Health Organization directives now.
Yeah, I was wondering if I could even
I
read the
know.
rules. Just because I do a kind of a challenge to read the Google to read the YouTube rules on YouTube. Would I get thrown off of YouTube for reading its own terms of service on
That'd
YouTube?
be really interesting.
I don't want to experiment with my channel, but just I wanted to do an interpretive reading, you know, a fair interpretive reading.
Well, you know, I mean, the World Health Organization just published a directive saying that widespread boosters campaign are simply not advised, right? And if you put that onto, this is World Health Organization, right?
Yep.
And if you put that on YouTube or Facebook, you know, you will be censored for doing so. So it's gone into just complete bizarro land.
Yeah, this is Yozerian censoring the zip code on letters in Catch-22,
right.
Changing the name
right.
of the street
arbitrarily,
you know. But it's worse. I
now,
mean,
here's, yeah. Now, I saw something the other day. This is what I got to tell you before. It came back to me, right? I don't watch CNN or MSNBC very often, right? And I guess this is, I forgot what the event was. It was some big news event, right? So I decided to turn CNN on, right? Mm-hmm. And in one commercial break, there were 5 drug commercials in a row. 5 of them.
You know, and I'll tell you, let me tell you the interesting thing about drug commercials. Tell me if you agree.
Okay.
Drug commercials generally have 2 parts. They have the how wonderful your life is going to be part, usually involving a man strumming a guitar on a white set. And then the second part about anal leakage, death from, you know, you know, if you take the asthma drug,
stroke,
you'll die of asthma.
Blindness.
Take the heart attack drug, you'll die of heart attack. You go blind, you go deaf, you go the
other. And meanwhile, you know, the man and woman are holding hands, like, you know, running through a wheel field where I can get it out, right? You know? And the doves are flying by.
Now, but they still have to say death, anal leakage, blindness,
anal leakage.
Death, blindness, stroke. Asthma, heart attack, stroke from the stroke drug. Okay.
Kidney failure
from the kidney drug. But the COVID, there's no ads for COVID. There's no commercial advertising for the COVID injection. The COVID injection, therefore, is exempt from this kind of fairness doctrine that is part of all the other pharmaceutical and biological advertising. And everyone just gets to say, safe and effective, effective.
Well, you know something? It's really weird, okay? There's this regulation. I looked into this once upon a time. And of course, the regulations say that, you know, for drugs, they have to talk about the side effects. Somewhere along the way, they changed the rules for vaccines that if it is a routinely given vaccine, you don't have to talk about the side effects. If it is not a routinely given vaccine, according to the rules, you're supposed to do it. All right. But of course they never do. Now, if there is, it's obvious the goal is to turn the COVID shot into something like a flu shot that has to be given every 6 months or once a year forever. Right. Mm-hmm. That's clearly the goal because that's where you maximize, you know, money making off of it.
Yeah. Repeat business. Yeah.
But it still isn't a regularly given one. A regularly given one would be like, you know, something like the regularly given shots to children, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow it simply could be because, you know, no one at the federal government is actually enforcing the law, which they actually do a lot of non-enforcement of law these days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that worked, because I could never wonder why with a vaccine ad, they never had to talk about any of the side effects.
Well, I was shocked one day when I saw one of these new flu shot, like, you know, 5-in-1, you know, 5 guesses in 1 flu shot. And they really did run the warnings. The warning, and now you can't repeat an ad. I was stunned. Now, the problem is I'm not always capturing all my audio whenever I'm surfing the net. And you can't repeat an ad. It's algorithmic. It's very clever that you can't repeat or capture an ad. So you've really got to set your viewing up for that day to capture the ads, but I'm looking at it thinking, well, this is interesting. They've got to say all this, and I've wanted to do a montage of all the warnings. You know, take all the imagine you take all the warnings from all the drug ads, and you just strung them together for an hour.
Right.
It would be quite heavy.
Very powerful.
To do that.
Which is just, I don't know, you know, what algorithm captured you, but I can't remember the last time I saw a vaccine ad on social media.
No, it was YouTube. It was on YouTube.
YouTube, for that matter. And, that just simply hasn't come across my radar screen.
They must have known I was getting ready to run right out to CVS and get a flu shot. I mean, they knew that all it would take would be one ad promising me a perfect life, and I would just run, not walk, down the block.
That's right. That's right. You could romp around those fields of wheat, you know?
So here's one thing that's utterly blowing my mind these days. I'm sure I'm not the only one. This COVID injection, the VAERS system, which, by the way, we should mention historically, was included in the 1986 Childhood Whatever Act as part of it. Took 4 years to get the thing online. They put it online 1990 or so. In 30 years, it captures reports of 9,000 deaths. And then in 2021, basically December to December, 20 to 21, it captures 21,000 deaths in one year from one group of products. More than doubling in 1 year the death rate of the previous three decades. Isn't there some regulatory switch that's supposed to get shut off? Can't someone hit the red button on their desk?
As Ed Norton would say, it's a mere bag of shells.
Explain this.
Did you ever watch The Honeymooners?
Oh, okay. Well, I watched The Flintstones. Does that count?
Well, actually, The Flintstones was the exactly. So Ed Norton was Art Carney, and there used to be this expression that's like, "Oh, that's a mere bagatelle," meaning, "Oh, that is just something that doesn't matter." But in Ed Norton's hearing of it, it came out as a mere bag of shells. So, yeah, to anybody who is like sort of, you know, kind of cognizant, you would think would set off alarm bells, you know. And here's the thing about VAERS. Okay, this is something. I was talking to a woman whose daughter is a pediatrician, right? And her pediatrician daughter says that anybody can submit anything to to VAERS, and you know, and it's all people looking to get a lawsuit going. All right, now two big problems with that. All right, here's a pediatrician who is the most likely person out there who support to report to VAERS. Yep. Right, one, she doesn't know that people can't sue anybody if they get hurt by a vaccine. Mm-hmm. Right, and two, the single largest source of reports of injuries to VAERS actually comes from the vaccine manufacturers themselves. So the vaccine manufacturers, hospitals, physician, and coroners account for 80 to 90% of all the reported injuries to VAERS. No injury reported to VAERS is ever reported until CDC verifies the circumstances of the injury and what actually happened before they allow it into the database, right? So, you know, the usual accusations made against VAERS to basically disallow it, to undermine its validity, are simply incorrect.
Plus, it's a felony if the doctor files a false report.
There you go.
They risk their license. It's a felony. And also, if someone is dead, then their family has to file the report. Dead people can't go onto a website that I know of. And so...
children or disabled people.
So, but here's the thing that I think is telling, regardless of that issue is that just on a comparative basis, that in 30 years there were 9,000 reported deaths, and in 1 year there were 21,000 reported deaths. We're talking apples to apples. So, right. And we're looking at something right. like a 60-fold increase right. in 1 year.
Right. Right. There's over a million COVID-related injuries now.
Yeah.
It's just mind-boggling. And, of course, as I'm sure you're aware, you know, the various studies that have been done about how many of the actual injuries are captured by VAERS sort of varies between, like, maybe 1 out of 40 to maybe 1 out of 100.
Yes.
So you got to put that multiplier on there, and when you put the multiplier on there, the reasonable multiplier that the federal government itself has come up with, you end up with probably far more deaths from the shot than COVID deaths that have been reported, and that's acknowledged. That's even ignoring the fact that the official death count of the United States includes, as has come out again, which we've known about for a couple of years, but as being admitted to in the last couple of weeks, along with everything else, they're admitting that includes people who died with COVID, and that it is a huge exaggeration of the actual number of deaths.
Yes. Yeah. And 95% had four. I just checked the CDC data. That 94% of reported COVID deaths, here's your with not of, had, among the broken legs, had 94% had four average, up from 2.6 a year and a half ago, four quote-unquote comorbidities, which is to say terminal illnesses, quote-unquote comorbidity. These are all life-threatening illnesses. These would all go on the certificate of death as contributing to the cause of death.
Right. And there's those extreme examples. I mean, I remember that sometime last year, a coroner in Colorado reported two deaths from gunshot wounds that ended up being reported as COVID deaths. And he made a stink about it and had them change it. But, I mean, I think that just goes to show how unreliable the whole thing is.
Well, Senator Dr. Jensen in Minnesota, I believe, did a personal study. He worked with someone who was a House of Representatives, you know, state rep, and they pooled their resources and got their friends to help, and they came up with 40% had nothing to do with any respiratory type thing. They included freshwater drownings, motorcycle accident,
right.
So Did you hear the interview with DePriest on Dell Bigtree? I forget her first name, and she was going over the vast amounts of money. Again, we're back to money that are paid if the person is vented. They must be given remdesivir, which kills them. The multiple organ failure is always remdesivir.
Right.
No virus causes your kidneys to fail and then your lungs to fill up and then all this stuff. It's remdesivir. They're giving them a deadly drug.
Sure.
If
you have somebody in hospital who's on a vent and remdesivir, that's it. They're gone.
Yeah.
Just a matter of time.
Right. And so when you calculate that 95% of average for coma. When you take, even the New York Wadsworth lab admits that the PCR is giving 90% false positives, what are you left with?
Wadsworth said that, huh?
Right in the New York Times. Celia Farber and I stared at each other for 5 minutes straight wondering how the hell that got out of the newspaper. But a whole bunch of epidemiologists backed this up, and Wadsworth. Mind you, the Times had already reported in 2007... that the test could give 100% false positives based on the Dartmouth-Hitchcock incident. Are you familiar with that incident?
No.
May I share this with you? So,
sure.
Good. Thank you. I thought you might want to hear about it. So in 2006, there was a suspected pertussis outbreak at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, which I jokingly say is the largest thing in New Hampshire. And so the suspicion consisted of some people coughing in, you know, a time of year with bad air quality in an institution with bad air quality, et cetera. But someone kind of panicked, and the panic kind of persisted long enough for them to say, let's test everyone. So they run everyone through the PCR. They sample thousands of people, and they come up with 140 or 41 or something PCR positives for pertussis, using, since it's an RNA thing they're checking, it's real-time reverse transcriptase, quantitative PCR, same basic type of assay used for COVID, because it's an RNA thing. But right. With pertussis, it is a bacteria. It can be easily and verifiably cultured, unlike a virus. And and what they found was, so meanwhile, they do splits. This is very important in any form of testing, to do splits, right? They send them to one building for bacterial culturing, and then they send them to the other building for PCR. They get 140 positives on the PCR. The place goes into a panic. They start injecting, contact tracing. Thousands of people are injected, so on and so on. Then, some weeks later, everyone gets an email saying, oops, nobody had it, because every single one of those was a false positive, because not a single one cultured. This is then I have personally verified this. It was reported, it made it into the Times, it made it into the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, an extensive special report on this the next year, and Dartmouth Hitchcock admits the entire thing.
Wow.
So to me, this says your RT quick real-time quantitative PCR for an RNA sample or whatever target, right, RNA target, is capable of 100% false positives. This is the tool they then use when they COVID rolls around. Corman and Drosten get busy, and they make a test up, and then we find out midway through the first year that this thing is blowing 90% false positives, only based on the cycle threshold. There's 10 other issues with the PCR.
Right.
So at any step of the PCR for this thing, there's a place to insert some form of fraud. So the reverse transcriptase phase is a complete and utter mess. The sampling is a complete and utter mess. They're running the thing at cycle threshold 45. How is it really possible to say that there is actually a crisis of anything other than this phony test?
Well, it all depends on what your goals are. I mean, if you want to generate hysteria and, you know, mass fear, that's the way to do it.
Yes.
You know? And the question what was the goal of generating this fear and mass hysteria?
Okay. Right.
What is it that they were trying to achieve? That's the billion-dollar question.
It is a lot more than $1 billion. We need to multiply this by all the money that was made. And I'm not being too cynical here. All the small businesses that went under to the great enrichment of Amazon and all the people kicked off of their platforms on Google. I just read this morning so we see a lot of different goals: massive consolidation of wealth, an attempted control of society. I see mostly an economic and political problem more than anything else.
Right.
And look,
is every catch 22?
Enough of it to get the idea. I didn't find it easy to read, but tell me what about it. I was mentioning Yossarian,
it like 40 years
Yossarian
ago.
Censoring the addresses and zip codes of the servicemen's letters.
I read it like in college, and I thought it was, you know, both chilling but hilarious at the same time. But there is one character in there, this sort of hustler in the army who's always looking to make a buck. And, he was in the Army. I guess he was in the Army Air Corps, right? And anyway, apparently, you know, just in the pursuit of business, he ends up making a deal with a German to pay the Air Force to bomb the Americans. And he has no particular feelings about it one way or another. It's just simply business, you know. And it, I think sort of Joseph Heller kind of saw which way the culture was going, you know. And I think that was a kind of just complete indifference to what actually happens to the world, you know, at large, if there's a great deal of personal profit involved in. I mean, my big theory about not only COVID, but much of the chaos that we see in society today is that our ruling elites have devolved into what I call careerist nihilists, right? They don't really believe in anything except their own personal, financial, and status advancement.
Mm-hmm.
And they just do whatever they perceive to be as necessary to enhance their own financial situation and their own status. And it is utterly immaterial what is required to do that. You know, most people will do that, right? And I think that applies to, obviously, the medical establishment, the political establishment, the media establishment, the financial establishment, whatever. I mean, that is where our ruling class is. They don't really believe in anything beyond that anymore. Therefore, they're sort of capable of anything that they perceive to be in their own term interests. That's the only reason I can, only way I can sort of make sense of what's going on in the world today. But if you do look at it from that perspective, a lot of what's going on makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes, in a very twisted way, perfect sense.
Yeah. You know, if that is, you know, if that's the standard by which you, you know, use to make your decisions, a lot of these decisions are perfectly rational.
One last concern I have.
Yeah.
Many people went out and took this COVID injection sincerely believing they were doing the right thing for themselves,
sure,
and their family and society.
Right.
And a lot of those people have gotten hurt.
Right.
And have hurt their loved ones.
Yes.
What do we say to them? And what can we do for
them? What do we say to them?
I mean, this troubles me spiritually. This is agonizing to me.
I think the only thing you can, you tell them the truth. It's just like, you know, basically, you need to understand that the people who have power in this society don't give a damn about you or your family or anything else but themselves, you know? And, you know, you fucked up. You trusted them.
Yeah.
That's like, again, to quote a movie, right? Did you ever see Animal House? Remember Animal
love
House?
It. Yeah, love it.
Okay. There's that line in there where Blutarsky, you know, the John Belushi character, looks at the two plebes coming into the fraternity and says, "You fucked up. You trusted me." That's where they're at. That's what happened.
And I had been through, you know, I'm coming up on, no one's given me an award yet, but I hit my 30th anniversary covering Monsanto late last year.
Oh, really? Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank you for your award.
Thank you very much. As along that journey, I saw many parents allow their students to be moved into PCB and dioxin-contaminated dormitories. The administration assured them it was safe and that the journalists covering it was crazy. And the parents, out of whatever convenience or trusting government officials, went along with it. So I saw this evil playing out right before my eyes, right in my own neighborhood, and had to reckon with it spiritually, in therapy, and as a journalist. most people think it's cynical to say these people do not have your best interests at heart, but they maybe have never seen state officials move students into a building that was soaked with PCBs and dioxins and assure them that it's good for their kids, meaning perfectly safe.
Right. Well, yeah, you can't. I mean, if you believe that, you know, that these people are looking out for your best interests, you can't explain reality. It just simply does not make sense, you know. But
right.
I also think that is so difficult for a lot of people to process that they just refuse to do it.
It takes down their whole house of cards. It can take down your whole cosmology to grapple with that.
Sure, sure.
Have you thought of this? Did you go through a process when your kid got hurt? Did you have to grapple with this?
Oh yeah. I mean, I had to come to terms with my, you know, I trusted people who I shouldn't have trusted, and you know, as a consequence, my kid is going to have no life, right? And there's, you know, the most vehement deniers of the injuries caused by vaccines, I have found to be other parents of children with autism.
This is what I was getting at the beginning of our conversation, John.
Yeah.
And I think that one thing that's going on is that people are afraid to admit that they made a decision that hurt their child.
Absolutely. You know?
A guilt complex.
And it's just too painful, I think, for them to bear, and they just completely reject it. And they react with just really extreme vehemence at anybody who would suggest that could have happened. You know, it's been happening to me for 20 years. I had some, and the same thing goes on with the healthcare professionals who cannot deal with the possibility that they have been injuring children. I don't think they set out to injure children, but they are completely blinded to the possibility that could be going on, and react with extreme vehemence against anyone who might make that suggestion.
Yeah.
Have that happen all the time.
Well, there's a good few layers to get through, and including the fact that they have personally profited from it.
Right.
And continue to to do so.
Right. And I also think their whole self perception is that they are, you know, benevolent people who help children. I mean, that is the, you know, that is their view of themselves. And what we suggest is incredibly threatening to that perception of themselves. And a lot of people can't tolerate that, to the point where they just, you know, you see this all the time, perfectly intelligent people who just simply reject any information that would suggest that could be the actual, state of affairs. They're just, you know, it's much, 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 it's essential for them to continue to believe again, the sort of lie that they've made about their lives, you know.
Which means filtering out or denying any information that could contradict.
Exactly.
But weird things happen. Like way back at the beginning of my PCB coverage at SUNY New Paltz, I get dragged in by a transformer accident. Not really an accident, really, because I knew it would happen. And one day, I got a big piece, and the Albany version of the Village Voice was a pretty big alternative weekly paper cover story, which we published on the day that the dorms opened throughout the SUNY system. So we were going to catch a lot of kids coming down from upstate through the Albany area, or all the Albany people, whatever, who might pick this thing up back in the day when people picked up these things. One student was so proud to be living in this famous dormitory that he hung the article up on the wall of his contaminated dorm room.
Uh-huh.
So this completely defies my ability to understand the state of mind that could lead to it. I just do not comprehend this combination of factors. And we have
one factor in that is you're talking about a 19-year-old who probably thinks, like most 19-year-olds, that they're completely indestructible.
You have a point there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't his parent who hung it up on the wall. It was he.
No, the parent wouldn't do that. Right.
No, the parents just went along with it. So I have to keep reminding myself, okay, these are, generally speaking, affluent enough to send their kid away to school, tending to be liberal-minded, left-leaning, Caucasian families, swallowed this pretty much hook, line, and sinker all throughout when the issue was hot in all throughout the 1990s.
Right.
Before the internet could corrupt them, before they had Twitter going off in their pocket every 30 seconds telling them what to be frightened of. And this is also happening in Prozac Nation, where people are not that happy, and they really want to believe that putting something in their body that Pfizer or somebody made is going to help them.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah. Where to from here for CHD and for Autism Action Network?
Well, you know, it's we've just got a huge amount of work to do, you know. I think part of it is you know, the main thing of it is getting sort of the truth out there in whatever ways we possibly can, you know, in this highly censored world in which we live, you know. And that's getting more and more difficult. Well, it's sort of interesting because it's getting more and more difficult to do on, you know, social media like Facebook and YouTube and things like that. But we're also at the point where, you know, Peter McCullough or Robert Malone are on the most highly rated television show in the United States now, right? Which I can't help but think the Joe Rogan appearances of those two guys must have been seen by the powers that be as just an overwhelming disaster. And I think it's really interesting that just within weeks of those two guys showing up on Joe Rogan, we are really seeing a very rapid deterioration of the dominant narrative over the last 2 years, right? It wasn't until then that they started fessing up to just some of the blatant lies that they've been propagating since day one, you know. Which gives me a great deal of hope, right? We've got this rally going on in Washington D.C. this weekend, which promises to be a really, really big deal. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a ton of people there, right? And so I'm hoping that this is indicative of a, you know, perhaps we're reaching a tipping point of sorts, that, you know, we're going to kind of reach a critical mass of people who are rejecting the manufactured viewpoint and moving towards the viewpoint that is actually supported by the data that's out there, you know. Mm-hmm. It's sort of funny, you know, because it's like, you know, for the anti-science people, we tend to be sort of very much focused
on the science.
On the science.
Who did a report? Someone MIT or someplace did a report that said, well, these people are really dangerous because not only are they, you know, delusional, they read all the scientific studies. This was
right.
A big story last year somewhere. It was like, oh, come on. I'm thinking, oh, please. You're still going to say they're anti-science because they read the scientific studies? This is big university.
Right.
It was some official publication describing the kind of COVID truther, anti-vaxxer kind of set. Saying, oh, far from being ignorant of the science, these people, you know, they read it all. It's like,
right, right.
Tell me, you're going to get through debate class here? You're going to really think this is going to win a debate class? Go ahead, please.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I mean, part of the problem they have is there's a lot of really well-educated people in the United States right now, mm-hmm. you know, people who can read scientific articles and understand them and see logical inconsistencies and suspicious treatment of data and could do the statistics and point out errors in the statistics. And I think this is a relatively new thing, you know, mm-hmm. that there's sort of been enough people out there with the skills to do this and also the sort of inclination to do such a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's also been just sort of a dramatic rise in the amount of sort of bogus science out there as well. So sometimes they don't, it's not too difficult to find this type of thing, you know? I mean, for example, there was this study that just came out of Denmark that according to their own experiments, their own data, and so on and so forth, it showed that after 90 days after the receipt of a booster shot, that the rate of contracting both Delta and Omicron strains of COVID was higher among the vaccinated people than unvaccinated people, right? You've gone into negative effectiveness, as they call it. Basically, you know,
negative effect,
that you're more likely to get it if you get vaccinated than if you don't, right? And it's right there on the paper, right? But of course, you see this a lot, you know? And the thing about it is I got to say that we didn't really get into this. We've been seeing this in the autism world for nearly a quarter century at this point. Just bogus article after bogus article after bogus article with blatant, huge issues that make the conclusions that are drawn from, you know, the supposed research absolutely nonsensical. This is sort of standard operating procedure in the autism world, mm-hmm. and much of it relates to vaccines. And so it's been the vaccine industry producing this stuff for a very, very long time, right? But attention on this type of thing was limited to this, like, very tiny slice of the population, you know, mostly people who had vaccine-injured kids who started actually delving into what was actually being said in the scientific literature, right? Now mm-hmm. it's gone worldwide, okay? You know, it's everybody is having these really bad encounters with the vaccine industry now, and they can't really cover it up anymore, right?
Yeah, and the social media censorship is not working so good.
No, you know,
all platforms are rising. You know,
right? You know, it's like the legacy media. I mean, it's they're on the, you know. You know, and I think one of the many factors in the sort of media hysteria about COVID is that they had to find something to sort of get the eyeballs looking at their products in the absence of President Trump. You know, all the legacy media and a lot of the new media.
Trump was great for their ratings.
Exactly. Their ratings took a massive hit. Well, how do you get them back? Well, let's say all this crazy shit about COVID scare the crap out of people so they keep on coming back. I mean, one thing we know about modern media is fear really sells. So, you know, to a great extent, they've become fear mongers because that gets attention. And that's really all they want is attention at this point because that's what they can monetize.
And it's become a psychiatric disorder in the population. I don't remember the name of the psychologist who was interviewed by Big Tree. I just grabbed the audio, played it last week. I'll think of his name, but
right, mass formation psychosis.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It wasn't Matthias Desmet. It was the one who came up with mass delusion psychosis in parallel with him. And Big Tree asked him when he knew something was wrong with consciousness in the population, and he said when he left the house feeling like he was entering a locked ward when he was an intern. It was the same feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lockboard.
Yeah. Right.
So.
Well, you know, I mean, there's some really weird stuff going on. All right, now. One of the things that I think is going on is that there is a small contingent of very powerful people in the world, in the United States, who want to establish reality for everyone simply by asserting that something is true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, I think we see this in the whole rise of transsexual issues in the United States and in other parts of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems overnight that somehow the only acceptable viewpoint one could have is that just because a person has Y chromosomes in every cell in their body and a penis, that doesn't mean that they're a male, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the pressure for this stuff is really coming from the transsexual world. Mm-hmm. I think this is coming from very powerful people who want to use this first and foremost as an exercise in defining reality for everybody simply by them asserting that something is true.
Mm-hmm.
That make sense to you?
Yeah. And people
and
are Swiss cheese right now because of their overexposure to digital conditions. Their ability to construct logical thought forms, their ability to prioritize what might or might not be more important has all been basically kind of crushed and leveled out by everything
right.
being run through digital platforms and digital equipment. It's transformed people into people who can't really think.
Or just having the ability to focus on a particular issue long enough to sort of reach a logical conclusion, you know, with processing the relevant information.
In context, yes.
You know, in a kind of coherent way, I think has really been damaged.
Yep. Sure, and there's always some new thing contradicting the next new thing. And this is intentional. This is being used by these kind of reality makers. You must remember the reality based community quote from back in the days during the Bush administration, where
right.
basically a Bush official
right.
later figured out to be Rove says, "We just make it up, and while you're busy writing it down, we're making up something new. And your problem is you're
right.
too reality based, and now we're an
right.
empire and we do whatever we want."
Right, right. That's a manifestation of the same type of thing, really. Yeah, it's certainly not a technique that's limited to, like, the quote-unquote left, whatever that means anymore, you know, or the quote-unquote right, whatever that means anymore.
Yeah, it's getting a little weird, huh? I mean, I thought it was weird when I would see Rachel Maddow. I kept catching her lying on issues I had covered or knew a lot about.
Right.
So fracking, she lies about fracking, she lies about Gardasil. Do you remember that episode where MSNBC, all the main primetime presenters, like, drew the wagons in a circle around how wonderful Gardasil is?
No, I don't recall that.
It wasn't quite Sarah Palin, but it was someone who said that, essentially admitted that there were Gardasil girls. And that this
right.
causes a problem that she mistakenly called retardation, but the problem is they were basically turned to zombies.
Right.
And this was initially quoted, and then the entire slate of top this MSNBC people maybe 10, 12 years ago, they drew the wagons in a circle and declared war on this viewpoint. I kept catching Maddow lie and lie and lie. None of this sounded very liberal to me.
No. Right.
I'm thinking, since when do liberals support the government position,
Trump
like,
companies.
Automatically?
Right, right. Since when are the FBI and the CIA the good guys? Since when do progressives trust unquestionably anything that comes out of a drug company? I mean, this is just unthinkable.
Unthinkable. There was a fabulous spoof ad that someone did a couple of weeks ago. He was like, I used to, comedian, very real casual looking guy with a Pfizer, obviously homemade Pfizer t-shirt on, saying, 10 years ago I was an Occupy Wall Street, but now I want Pfizer tat to occupy my sleeve. I believe that drug companies are 99.9% evil, except Pfizer. It was a fantastic satire on this viewpoint of caving to this. Maybe we've reached the bounce point. I mean, something has definitely shifted. This is about the third time recently that I have just felt another kind of crumbling and a kind of free fall of like this monolithic viewpoint.
Right.
Well, thank you.
I'd love to see that one.
I'll try to find it. Listen, thank you for doing your part. I have greatly admired your work. I keep running into you at events, and your legislative talk at ArcLight that time was fantastic. CHD has been on the front line, getting a bestseller out of a Fauci book. Wow.
That was pretty clever.
it worked. Yeah. A lot of work went into that thing, but it did. They pulled it off. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, listen. Any closing thoughts? You're welcome to share. Otherwise, I'll bid you good afternoon.
Not really. Just keep on doing what you're doing. Keep on doing your work. You know, and it's more important now than ever. And it's always been very important. So, keep on doing what you're doing.
John.
You know, maybe you could save NPR. This is on it. You work with an NPR station, right?
No, Pacifica. I'm the dissident Pacifica.
Oh, Pacifica.
Affiliate.
Okay.
You know, I'm the Rush Limbaugh.
Sort of problem.
I'm the Rush Limbaugh of the Pacifica network. I'm the far right lunatic fringe of the.
Uh-huh.
So I'll tell you my far right position. Stop the death penalty, end wars, free the prisons. I'm in favor of immigration. Anything else? So that makes me a far right winger.
Free the black shirt.
Happy to be, as usual, on the lunatic fringe.
Yeah. So, well, keep it up.
John, thank you.
All right, thanks, sir.
Yeah, till next time.